Amator Magicus. Well-known expertio alter, delectare animus hominum risusque movere. Namque, nova scena sintulit, et res ridiculas quique adiutis. Cui non
bene. I remember reading about Woodhouse before the war. He had come to get a prize at Oxford. It was an honorary degree from Magdalen. I remember a photograph, this large, childlike man staring out from a group of dons, his expression polite but out of place. And I identified him, the comic master receiving this honor from academia, as a fellow traveler, lost, bewildered, his face contorted into a gratitude he did not feel.
Woodhouse! 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 Woodhouse!
Well, thank you. Thank you.
But what else had we in common? He, the doyen of popular comic literature, whose chinless heroes roamed a permanent, fictive Edwardian summer, and I, George Orwell, who had no heroes, only baffled protagonists, wandering through a landscape rich in aspidistra, but pitifully short of gin and tonics. What had we in common? I did not know in that summer of 1939, as war clouds gathered over Europe, that soon our lives would be intertwined and our reputations so strangely married.
It was terrible.
Never mind.
All those people.
You're back now.
I was expecting to say something funny.
What, did you?
No.
You mean you didn't tell them about Smith? The man with the silent P.
Do you know I didn't?
As in ptarmigan, psalm, thesis.
No.
You should have done.
I feel sort of uncomfortable in England. Isn't that odd?
Why?
I mean, I'd rather be here. We like France, don't we, Ethel?
We do.
Why?
What would you like for tea?
I mean, I'm English, aren't I?
Francoise is doing pork.
What?
Nice piece of pork. Thought you'd like that.
Le Touquet in 1939, the Isle of Wight with a French accent, where the Woodhouses lived. Le Touquet with its community of expats, no doubt the same the world over, just like the ones I'd met in Malaya, or like the ones, in fact, I met at my father's house in Southwold. The same attitudes, the same cosy consensus from which each day Woodhouse would escape to his workroom. Another similarity between us.
Morning, Jeeves.
Good morning, sir.
How's the weather, Jeeves?
Exceptionally clement, sir.
Anything in the paper?
Some slight friction threatening in the Balkans, sir. Otherwise, nothing.
But how exactly did I become involved, and why? Any life viewed from the inside is a series of defeats. A man who gives a good account of himself is probably lying, and so only disgrace can be trusted. But whose disgrace? Not mine alone. The war, when war came, was an act of national exposure. If we didn't know ourselves before, then we soon would.
The blow fell precisely at 1:45, summer time. Spencer, Aunt Agatha's butler, was offering me the fried potatoes at the moment, and such was my emotion that I lofted 6 of them onto the sideboard with a spoon. Shaken to the core, if you know what I mean.
Plum? It's time to leave.
Is it?
It's time. I told you.
Have you packed?
Everything I could.
What's the matter, dear?
I don't think you want to come.
Hmm?
To England.
I don't mind. We'll rent a little bungalow, shall we, in Dorset or Gloucestershire.
I knew you didn't.
Are the Germans coming?
Yes. The Panzers. And the Stukas. They'll soon be here.
Will they?
They've broken through.
Oh.
That's why Archie says we have to go, and since he's offered us a lift...
Because of the Panzers and the Stukas.
That's right.
Yes. It's not like we have any choice, then.
No. At least, Archie said we didn't.
Right.
I'm sorry, Plum.
All aboard? Got enough room, you two?
Oh, yes, no complaints.
We're fine, Archie.
Good. Now, let's see if we can get this thing to start. That's perfectly reliable, these French cars. There she goes.
Pipe down, you two.
They're all comfy.
Yes.
Oh, he looks comfy.
Oh, how's he managed that?
Plum is always comfortable. It's a gift.
Right so.
He'll be asleep in a minute.
You all right?
Yes.
You sure?
Shut up.
Anyone know any songs?
Song?
Oh, I've got one. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to... Well, come on, everybody.
It's a long way to Tipperary.
To the sweetest girl I know. Whoa. Hang on.
I can imagine the look on his face when Archie's Citroën broke down. And when he carried the suitcases back to Latouque, he'd have been smiling. Yes, despite the Panzers and the Stukas. Smiling, I think.
There are a few things I like better than a walk in the French countryside carrying a suitcase.
Where's the key?
Yeah.
Now in space for hum.
Perhaps they won't be so bad, Ethel. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, the Nazis, they haven't exactly had a good press.
Well, they look after their dogs, though.
Oh, do they?
Apparently.
Well, that's something.
So they can't be all bad.
And now we're going to find out.
Mr. and Mrs. Woodhouse, my name is Commandant Dryd, sir.
It's very pleasant, a very pleasant house. May I say how much I admire your books?
You've read...
Certainly, your books.
Oh, that's very nice, isn't it, darling?
Very nice.
Oh, not at all.
Thank you.
When I was at university at Durham...
You were at Durham?
Yes, 1932 to 34, I studied theology and archaeology. I remember my surprise to discover amongst my British contemporaries that your books were considered light.
They are light.
Popular, perhaps.
We hope so, don't we, Plum?
But light? Oh, in my own country, you are considered to be a social satirist.
Well, I never knew that.
Certainly, with a merciless eye which you train on the foibles of the British aristocracy.
Would you like some lemonade?
Ah, now that would be very nice.
I'd given up the Malay police force and come home. My father couldn't understand it. His manner of expressing disapprobation was ruthless silence, combined with a sudden overpowering need to look out of the window. His garden was never more fascinating to him than when he was angry with me. "What are you going to do?" his back said. But in those early months, those months of the phony war, what could I say to him? For he was dying, and as his final illness took hold, I felt I had nothing to offer him. No future he could imagine. And so I, too, turned away. "What are you going to do?" he said, meaning with your life. I took a book down from the shelf. "Oh, read," I mumbled something. "Try and sort myself out." He looked at the book I was holding. "Do you like P.G. Woodhouse?" he said. What was it my father saw in those books? I never asked him. But in the month that Germany invaded France, I began reading to him from the works of P.G. Woodhouse. And so, when I look back to this time and ask myself what first interested me in the case, I always associate it with summer evenings in Suffolk, as I sat by my father's bedside.
"I say, Jeeves, sir. Mix me a stiffish brandy and soda." "Yes, sir." "A stiffish, Jeeves. Not too much soda, but splash the brandy about a bit." "Very good, sir." "Jeeves, sir. I rather fancy I'm in the soup, Jeeves.
Indeed, sir.
Yes.
Right up to the hocks.
Plum. Plum.
Mm.
You've got to come down.
Why?
The commandant.
Again? Why?
Come, come down.
It is not my wish.
No, we don't blame you.
I argued, believe me, this man is old, nearly 60. What harm can he do to the Third Reich?
None.
Of course not.
You didn't get anywhere. They didn't listen?
No.
They never listen, do they? They never listen.
No.
Plum.
That's my experience. Never listen.
You're tired.
No?
Would you like to lie down?
And now I must be interned with Archie. Sounds like a joint burial.
I'm sorry, you've been very nice to me.
No.
Well.
Mrs. Woodhouse, you're angry, legitimately.
I'm going to make a cup of tea.
Hey. Now, where is the prison camp? Where is it?
Liège.
Ah, I've never been to Belgium.
I'm very sorry.
No, not a bit of it. Would you like tea or something stiffer? Oh, I say. Plum, did you see that, Archie? The French are very rough, aren't they?
Are you getting your letter?
No, I haven't had one.
Well, shall we speak to the camp commandant?
Oh.
What?
Well, I'd rather not.
No?
Frightful, isn't it?
Oh, frightful.
We could wait.
You mean for a week or something?
Yeah, or a fortnight.
Or a month. No need to rush it.
No. There! What do you think of that? Is that a foul?
You look hungry, Englishman.
I beg your pardon.
I say, old man, you look hungry.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. I'm nearly finished here.
Would you like my soup?
What?
Englishman, eat.
You're giving me...
Old man, you're hungry. Eat.
But I say that's really very, very kind. Thank you.
And that summer, two things came together. The dying father I saw at weekends, and my job at the BBC during the week, where I encountered the person who would, unknown to him, stamp himself so strongly on my life. Duff Cooper, the Minister for Information. It was under Duff Cooper that I learned that truth is malleable, that it is something that can be polished and bent until it fits the requirements of a war, of a nation. It was a message I found not only repulsive, but terrifying. And every weekend, as I took the train back to Southwold, it seemed to me that I was entering a world of darkness. As the train left London and merged into the Suffolk flatness, I gripped my book harder and stared up into a starless night, dreaming of young men who lunch in Piccadilly and afterwards go on to their clubs for cards.
Yeah. Plum! Good God!
Do you like the uniform?
Very dashing! What are you doing here?
Foreign office, don't you know?
Ah, I see, but...
No, I've come to see you.
Have you?
I saw your name on a list of prisoners.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
Oh, no, an old friend.
Well, yes,
Of course I came. My God. It seems a long time ago, doesn't it?
Yes, the back lot of the Warner Brothers.
Yes, downtown, Bungalow 49.
I was Bungalow 47.
Yes, yes, you had the view.
Yeah, I had the view, that's true.
Busby Bartley's babes as they passed.
Oh, I never looked.
No, I don't think you did. And what was his name, that Jew?
Who?
Goldberg.
Oh, yes. Listen, boys, I want those scripts and I won them yesterday. So get your dirty little fingers out of your asses and try pressing them down on the keys once in a while. Charming man.
I'd kick his ass if he tried to speak to me like that nowadays.
What did we ever do? Did you ever complete a script?
Eh?
And I've never been so well paid for doing nothing. So now you're,
Yes, as you see.
Yes, so, well, what is one supposed to say?
Oh, it's a mess.
One day it'll be over.
Are they looking after you?
No, I can't complain. I'll be out soon.
Oh, is it so?
On my 60th birthday.
What?
Yeah, I've checked up.
Well, then I'm sure you're right. Ah, God, yeah, I look back on those Hollywood days with such a sense of... I don't know. We were so carefree, weren't we?
Yes. Don't tell anyone. I still am.
I think you are. You have kept something, a little candle of innocence.
Oh, my gosh. Ignorance, more like.
Oh, perhaps. God, some secret, though. Whereas I...
The weight of the world, eh?
And I mean, example, eh? My betters.
The top brass?
Yes, yes. They're on my back.
Oh, what's that for? Well,
you wouldn't believe it. They've spoken to me.
Oh, yes, yes, I know.
Now, let me tell you. These people want to know something. Which is this, can I find something they want?
Oh, what do they want you to find?
Everybody wants something. Ah, you're looking at me. I'm not explaining this, am I? I must be nervous. Why am I nervous?
Oh, don't be nervous.
All right, listen. Can I be frank, Plum? Can I?
My dear old Verna.
They want something. They're in charge of communications, and they want someone to do some broadcasting. You see, they said to me, Verna, you knew showbiz types. You worked with them. Who could you suggest? You see? That's what they want, a suggestion. Or even a short list. I mean, do I have such a thing?
I don't know. Do you?
Oh, look at me going around the houses. Here it is. They want someone to make some broadcasts to America. And I said to them, I assured them that I could do it, you see? Now, why did I do that?
Impressing the top brass.
How stupid can you be, eh?
Now, what are these broadcasts for?
To impress the Yanks. That's all. Nothing. I don't really understand it.
Oh, poor old Verna. If I had any scotch, I'd offer you one.
dear Plum. Dear Plum. I don't know why... Why do I burden you? We haven't seen each other for...
What?
No, it's all right. I just had an idea. It's ridiculous.
What?
No, it doesn't matter.
What?
You will promise me that you'll be absolutely frank with me.
Yes.
Would you do it?
Would I?
Would you? If somebody came to you and put it to you to make a series, a short series, I don't know what, talks.
You mean?
Little sketches. I don't know. It wouldn't have to be a great trouble.
You won't.
It's an idea.
What could I write about?
Prison life.
Prison life?
Observations.
Prison life. A crowd pleaser, you think?
Oh, you could do it.
Your faith in me would be touching if it weren't so sadly misplaced.
You could do it.
I don't know.
Of course you could.
I could try.
Oh, you could, if anybody could.
You think so?
Blowing it off? Oh, yes. But would you?
To help out an old friend? In a flash, normally.
Oh, I understand. I just don't believe I have any right to ask you.
Oh, no, you're talking to me.
I know. It's just...
Shall I think about it?
No, that's the trouble. They want an answer. I mean, they want to know, today, have I come up with someone? I mean, it's impossible.
Well, I have to think about it.
Oh, of course. They would be astounded. I know they would.
Still, I'd better think about it, Verna. Yes?
Oh, right. Oh, by the way, some letters have come through for you.
Dear Mr. Woodhouse, I understand from a newspaper article that you've been interned by the Germans. This is a bitter blow for you, I'm sure, to be parted from your wife and loved ones. However, with God's blessing, you'll be home soon. In the meantime, may I tell you how much pleasure your books have given to me and my family over a number of years? As somebody said, there is nothing greater than the gift of laughter. And that gift you have in abundance. May the Lord bless you and bring you safely home. Yours most sincerely.
Come.
Verna.
You said you would consider my invitation to broadcast.
Verna, I can't seem to make up my mind.
Look, Plum, I need your help.
It's just this dashed question of propriety.
It's to America. It's just to America.
Right.
And you have many American fans who would be grateful to hear from you, surely.
Oh, yes, that is true.
And the Americans are not part of this dreadful war.
Aren't they lucky?
The Yanks are always lucky. So...
I know. I just...
I understand.
Plum, do you remember that bar we used to go to? After work? On Sunset? What was the name of it? Run by this little fellow with... Sanchez. Mexican. And we called him Sandy. Do you remember? And we'd go in there, always the same seat, the far end. I can see it. And you'd say, two beers, something like that, give our order. And he'd say, don't you want a nice cup of cha, boys? Because he thought we were both English. He thought I was English. And you. In the end, you pretended to be an American. I couldn't do the accent, but you could. What was the name of that place? You remember?
The Golden Apple.
Yes. You remember.
Owing to having led a blameless life since infancy, I have never seen the interior of a calaboose before. And directly I set eyes on the official in the front office, I regretted I was doing so now. There's probably no one in the world less elfin than a German prison official. And the one now twirling his moustache at me looked like something out of a film about Devil's Island. Still, an author never quite gives up hope, and I think there was just a faint idea at the back of my mind that mine host, on hearing my name, would start to his feet with a cry of, "What? Herr Woodhouse, embrace me, my dear sir, and offer me his bed for the night," adding that he'd long been one of my admirers, and would I give his little daughter my autograph. Nothing like that happened. He just twirled his moustache again, entered my name in a large book, or rather, he put down Widhorse, silly son of a bachelor, and motioned to the bash bazooks to lead me to my cell.
And so partly because I was reading P.G. Woodhouse to my father, and partly because of the unhappiness in my own life at the time, I was struck when I heard that my father's hero had begun to make broadcasts for the Germans. The fact that the broadcasts were innocuous was not relevant. They had been made by an Englishman for his country's enemy in wartime. I was anxious that my father would not hear about them, and so, as I settled down to read to him, I did not mention them. And throughout this same time, I sensed a trouble brewing for myself. It seemed to me that something was approaching I would not be able to avoid, did not want to avoid, though as I turned the pages under the lamp, or resettled my father's bedclothes, I could not tell what it was.
Once a year, Jeeves takes a couple of weeks vacation and biffs off to the sea or somewhere to restore his tissues. Pretty rotten for me, of course, while he's away, but it has to be stuck, so I stick it. And I must admit that he usually manages to get hold of a fairly decent fellow to look after me in his absence. Well, the time had come round again, and Jeeves in the kitchen, giving the understudy a few tips about his duties. I happened to want a stamp or something, and I toddled down the passage to ask him for it. The silly ass had left the kitchen door open, and I hadn't gone two steps when his voice caught me squarely in the eardrum. "You will find Mr. Wooster," he was saying to the substitute chappie, "an exceedingly pleasant and amiable young gentleman, but not intelligent. By no means intelligent. Mentally, he is negligible. Quite negligible."
"How is the BBC?" my father asked me. "Oh, very well," I replied. "Everything's very well." And at that moment, several ideas came together in my mind. First of all, a face. Not Woodhouse's, but Duff Cooper's. The Minister for Information. His picture. Posted on every wall throughout the land. And with that face, a voice, terrible, unstoppable, braying out its message from every speaker. But only the voice. I could not yet hear the words.
beef.
Lovely.
With trimmings, William?
Oh, whatever's on offer, Mr. Cooper.
I have a favour to ask, William.
Oh, yes.
P.G. Woodhouse.
Yes?
Has betrayed his country.
I heard one of the broadcasts. Very boring.
Is it boring, William? To lie in your own nest at the expense of your countrymen, is it? And would you say it was boring to ignore the cries of a million orphans?
No, of course.
Woodhouse is an example of a blithe spirit. Very blithe. Many of his friends and his readership will say that he is innocent. Well, innocent in this case because innocent by nature. They'll say he was foolish, had gone too far. The network of pals will close around their chum. Well, I will not have it, William. It's not within my nature to stand by and allow my nation to be spat upon, no matter how innocent the spitter. Yes, William?
No, I see. I see what you're saying.
And so, the case of Mr. Woodhouse presents us with a duty, a very clear duty.
Yes?
I would like the Daily Mirror, through the good offices of your column, William, to deliver the nation the bleeding and crumpled form of Mr. P.G. Woodhouse, figuratively speaking, fresh from the good moral kicking you have just given him. Your forte, William. Will you do it?
To help the war effort, Mr. Cooper?
Yes.
Of course I will.
Then, afterwards, through the equally good offices of the BBC...
The broadcast?
I'd say so. It behoves us to use the media at our disposal, don't you think?
Oh, yes.
Yes, so do I. Ah, here's the waiter.
Something terrible had emerged. A monster from a cracked shell. Something fully formed, blind and terrifying, had stumbled to its clawed feet, and with its first cry had announced the nature of its appetites.
We're to carve him up.
Oh? Did he discuss the angle?
He didn't have to.
Oh? He left it to you?
Yeah. Said it was my forte.
I can see you've already decided the line you'll take.
Mm. Toffee-nosed bastard P.G. Woodhouse betrays sufferings of common man.
Need an edge on that, William.
In a life of luxury, living on well-fed delusions, he turns his back on the hand that fed him.
Hmm. It has legs.
Ah. Nazi scourge finds propaganda helpmate in stuck-up pomps.
Language, of course. Nothing offensive.
Oh, well. Stuck-up prayer.
Have to consult the thesaurus on that one.
While the average Englishman suffers to repel the evil wave of Nazism, this representative of the drooling classes pockets 40 pieces of silver from the hands of fascist paymasters whilst holed up in luxury Berlin hotel. What kind of Englishman is this? Not too self-righteous, is it?
Well, not at all, William. Not at all.
Cooper was at the BBC the next day. I saw him as he was scuttling out of a lift, on his way, as history would show, to the Director General's office.
Mr. Cooper.
Can I assume you've read Cassandra's script, Mr. Ogilvy?
Yes, of course.
So, I want you to tell me when you're going to broadcast it.
I have some objections to it.
I'm sorry?
I have some objections.
Objections? Do you?
Three, in fact.
Ah.
May I...
What?
May I tell you them? Mr. Cooper?
Yes?
One, the evidence against Woodhouse is scanty, however ill-advised he may have been.
Was.
I beg your pardon?
Was ill-advised.
However ill-advised, he is by no means in the same category as Lord Haw-Haw.
Well, we think that's too soon to say. Well, does that conclude?
I have two more objections to allowing a broadcast against Woodhouse. The talk, as scripted, would be right out of character with anything the BBC has ever done. It is personal, and it is made by a journalist with a notorious reputation.
Come, come.
I beg your pardon?
Come, come, Mr. Ogilvy. Cassandra is a modern and effective journalist. He pulls no punches. To which of these admirable qualities do you object?
Thirdly,
when he sees a spade, he doesn't call it a long-handled digging instrument. Well, I realize that may not be within the traditions of the BBC. Perhaps it should be. Thirdly,
any small success of such an attack against Woodhouse would be short-term.
Yes?
We are depended upon by our listeners not to pursue the sort of crowd-baiting sensationalism that this man's approach exemplifies.
Is that all? Well, have I heard your big guns now?
I feel it's my duty.
Yes. Well, I feel it's my duty to attack Britain's enemies. With the powers I have as Minister of Information, I consider that this broadcast will aid the war effort.
I fail to see.
You don't have to see. You will make a studio available.
Mr. Ogilvy?
I have come to tell you tonight of the story of a rich man trying to make his last and greatest sale, that of his own country. It is a somber story of self-respect, of honour, and of decency being pawned to the Nazis for the price of a soft bed in a luxury hotel. It is a tale of laughter growing old, and of the Judas whine of treachery taking its place. It is the record of P.G. Woodhouse ending 50 years of money-making fun with the worst joke he ever made in his life, the only wisecrack he ever pulled that the world received in silence. 50,000 of my countrymen are enslaved in Germany. They went through an inferno of flame and steel so that democratic England might live. They have lost everything. Many of them are dead. But they have something that Woodhouse can never regain, something that 30 pieces of silver could never buy. Yesterday, I was in South London, Mr. Woodhouse, during an air raid. Near me, under 5, 15, 50 tons of rubble, lay human beings, most of them dead, some of them alive, a few of them dying. Your countrymen, Mr. Woodhouse. You should have been there, Mr. Woodhouse. You, with your impartiality, your reasonableness, and perhaps even one of your famous little jokes. Good night to you, Mr. Pelham, Grenville, Woodhouse.
The next day, I resigned from the BBC. As usual, at the weekends, I travelled to Southwold. One day my father said to me, "Are you writing anything at the moment?" Surprised, I lied. "Yes, an article. About P.G. Woodhouse." His face brightened. "Oh, good," he said. "At last, something popular." I had my subject. In defense of P.G. Woodhouse. When the Germans made their rapid advance through Belgium in the early summer of 1940, they captured, among other things, Mr. P.G. Woodhouse.
That's the Daily Mirror.
Aye.
And that's the Express.
You never said that.
I know.
You never said you were giving a cocktail party when you were arrested.
And the Telegraph.
So why are you reading
In
all
which
these?
There's a letter from Ian.
Support it?
No.
Show me. Not bad.
That's very bad.
He
says, "No broadcast from Berlin by a world-famous Englishman, however neutral in tone, can serve as anything but an advertisement for Hitler, as a testimonial to Nazi toleration, an ingenious dose of soothing syrup for America, designed to divert American thoughts from the horrors which are being perpetrated in German prison camps today upon thousands of persons less happily situated than Mr. Woodhouse."
Listen, if you just...
I'll write to them. I'll ask them to see me.
They'll never forgive you, Tom.
Your coffee. Oh.
What does he want?
He wants to know if we want cream.
Oh, God, what have I done?
But why? Why should a few rather silly but harmless remarks by an elderly novelist have provoked such an outcry? One has to look for the probable answer amid the dirty requirements of propaganda warfare.
"I have learned that speaking on the enemy wireless during wartime is not considered an offence. Well, if this is so, it very soon ought to be made one. In my opinion, Mr. Speaker, Woodhouse's offence is covered by the Treason Act, which names it treason if a person intends to act in a way which strengthens the king's enemies and has tended to weaken the country. And a person who happens to clown on the enemy wireless is committing just as much an act of treason towards this country as Lord Haw-Haw himself.
I wrote, certain of my aim, and with a growing conviction that this would not be all. Few things in this war have been more morally disgusting than the present hunt after traitors and quislings. At best, it is largely the punishment of the guilty by the guilty. In England, the fiercest tirades against quislings are uttered by conservatives who were practicing appeasement in 1938 and communists who were advocating it in 1940. I have striven to show how the wretched Woodhouse became the corpus vile in a propaganda experiment, and I suggest that it is now time to regard the incident as closed.
Mr. Woodhouse.
Major Cousin?
Yes.
I don't know whether we...
Somewhere we could go.
My room?
It stopped raining. Shall we try the street?
Well, I
shouldn't to be in Paris and never leave one's hotel.
Yes, well, I've been advised not to go on the streets. Apparently the local people are searching like mad for traitors and quislings, and apparently I'd fit the bill. Do you mind awfully if we do stay here?
There's no one to hurt you out there. Nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah, all the same...
Look, I've got my revolver. I'll defend you to the death.
Oh, I say.
Shall we?
So, what is it you want to ask me? How can I help you?
Thank you for your letter. I shall need to take a statement from you by and by. Perhaps tomorrow. Do you know any restaurants around here?
I eat at the hotel. Are you hungry?
No, this is Paris.
Well, it's changed. When were you last here?
I brought a girl here in 1936.
Oh, I see. Well, I expect your memories are rosier than the reality.
Well, isn't that always the case?
Listen, why didn't... I wanted to ask you...
Yes?
Why didn't they ask me back to England for this interview?
Do you want to go there?
Well, I did.
I shouldn't think about going back.
Why? Oh, I see. You think they're going to prosecute me as a traitor?
No.
I don't understand.
And Mr. Woodhouse, certain factions at home are baying for your blood.
The government?
No, not the government. They more or less know that there's no case against you.
Then who?
The stirrers up. The people whose careers benefit from controlling mass feeling.
Journalists?
And certain members of the establishment.
But why do they do that?
They want to create some sort of consensus. And with themselves at the heart of it. The easiest consensus is in opposition to an enemy. Let us agree on who we hate. That sort of thing. And you're it.
Well, why don't you tell them that?
I will report. It's a circular motion. It's like a circle. I will deliver a report on a matter which the government has already decided on. There is no case against you. That will be their decision.
Then I can go home?
No.
Why?
Let's cross the bridge. You're still riding?
Oh, yes. Do you...
I don't read novels.
Well, mine aren't really... that's odd. I don't think of them as novels. They're books.
I must say, I don't read books either.
No?
Perhaps I will.
Well, I don't think you'd like them.
What exactly do you write about?
Oh, young men. Foolish young men. Getting into all sorts of scrapes and bothers. They're usually rescued by a butler or a bright young woman. I write about strict aunts and dyspeptic uncles and fine dinners in country houses and walks on moonlit evenings, that kind of stuff.
With happy endings?
Oh, yes, always happy endings. I mean, that's what we want, isn't it? I wanted to... You know, sometimes I think about walking down Piccadilly. I dream about it. Nothing like it. Or else some peerless morning in the Gloucestershire countryside, mist through trees, and you know the sun will come up later and will give you a perfect day. I'll never go back, will I?
It's easier if you didn't.
Even though I haven't broken any laws?
No one in the government can afford to forgive you. I mean, can be seen to forgive you.
Oh, I say. What a business, eh?
Yes.
isn't it?
How is your article? My father asked. I finished it, I said. Will you read it to me? He said. I leaned closer and held his hand. I felt the pulse in his thin wrist. I realized I had always lied to him, that he had set the rigid conditions of our relationship, and I had obeyed, that there could never be any truth between us. Yes, I said, of course I will. And he forgot, as I knew he would, and 2 weeks later he died. But when I sent the article on P.G. Wodehouse off for publication, I found, as I had suspected, that the story would not leave me. There was a further story to tell, in which the innocent, or virtually innocent, are held for sacrifice in a society managed by propaganda. A society modern and yet barbaric. A society in which lies are truth and slavery freedom. A world in which the brotherly face of the Minister for Information smiles down from every bombed street corner, whilst from every speaker a braying voice urges a bewildered people to hatred. I will write a novel, I thought.
One thing I was certain of, and that was that this was where Jeeves and I parted company. A topping valley, of course, none better in London, but I wasn't going to allow that to weaken me. I buzzed into the flat like an east wind. And then, through the doorway, there shimmered good old Jeeves, in the wake of a tray full of the necessary ingredients, and there was something about the mere look of the man. I started to calm down in the first 2 seconds. It was like one of those moments in a play where the chappie, about to steep himself in crime, suddenly hears the soft, appealing strains of the old melody he learned at his mother's knee. Softened, I mean to say. That's the word I want. Softened. Whiskey, sir? Thanks. Jeeves? Sir? Oh, nothing. Not all the soda, Jeeves. Very good, sir. Oh, Jeeves? Sir? I wish, that is, I think, nothing. Very good, sir. The cigarettes are at your elbow, sir. Dinner will be ready at 7:45 precisely. Unless you desire to dine out. No, I'll dine in. Yes, sir. Jeeves? Sir? Oh, nothing. Very good, sir.
George Orwell's last novel, 1984, was published a year before his death in 1950. P.G. Wodehouse took up residence in the United States after the war. He was created a Knight Commander of the British Empire in 1975, the year of his death. He never returned to England. Plum's War was written by Michael Butt, with Benjamin Whitrow as P.G. Wodehouse, Nicholas Farrell as George Orwell, and Henry Goodman as Werner Plack. Gillian Barge was Ethel Wodehouse, Colin Baker was Duff Cooper, Stephen Boxer was Frederick Wolfe Ogilvie, David Glover was Major E. Cusson, and Michael Tudor Barnes was Cassandra. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Plum's War, directed by John Taylor, was a Fiction Factory production for BBC Radio 4.